on the road again. I just can't wait to get on the road again.
Which we do on a regular basis with Steve Grumpster. Grumpy Collins, good morning.
Hey, good morning and happy Easter to you, Tony.
Where are we going for... Now, I hope you've come up with some sort of Easter theme for our little travelling spot somewhere in Australia.
I have.
I'll bet
I've come
you
up
have.
With an Easter theme and a Christmas theme as well. We're going to visit two islands, Easter Island and Christmas Island.
Easter Island.
So, yes. Mm. Now, Easter Island, as... was discovered by a Dutch navigator called Roggeveen on the April the 5th, 1722, which just happened to be Easter Sunday. I think that'll be the same because tomorrow's the 3rd, Saturday's the 4th, and Sunday is the 5th of April. So how about that for a coincidence? It's, of course, 2026. So there's 304 years ago, basically, it was discovered. Now, the only thing, of course, people have been living there for a lot longer.
A long time.
And the local name for Easter Island is Rapa Nui. And it is part of Chile. It's a province in Chile. And it's over 2,000 kilometres from the nearest inhabited island. And so the local people... that found it. They reckon they went there round about the 12th century. They were Polynesian sailors, and they must have travelled for a long time to get there, because presumably went from somewhere in Polynesia, which, as I said, is over 2,000 kilometres away, and they came across this island, which is not an easy place to get to, and also there's a lot of cliffs there. There's some extinct volcano, it's really a harsh sort of place to conquer.
At that time, it wouldn't be particularly inviting, you wouldn't have imagined.
Well, it would be inviting if you haven't seen anything for a couple of thousand days.
I suppose you would
want to go there. But say they got to what they call Rapa Nui, we call Easter Island. They had an interesting way of navigating the Polynesians, because they were very, very skilled seafarers, because they basically conquered the whole of the South Pacific, including, of course, New Zealand, because the Maori were Polynesians as well, I think. So they travelled everywhere, and of course they went up, the Polynesians went as far as Hawaii, etc. So they were amazing, because they were amazing navigators, because they travelled in these large double-hulled canoes. They didn't have proper ships or anything like that. And they used to navigate by using, the stars at night, but they could read the ocean currents, and they could read the wind patterns, and they would all find out where follow birds. If they could see some birds out at sea, they would follow them. So they had an extraordinary way of navigating, and as I say, they came across Rapa Nui, or Easter Island as we know it. And the main town of Rapa Nui is called Hangaroa. And
Hangaroa.
It is part of Chile. Hangaroa, H-A-N-G-A-R-O-A. It's very, very isolated. It used to be covered in forest because it was volcanic soil. And as you know, volcanic soil is very, it creates a lot of lush forestry and plants and stuff. Unfortunately, although it was well forested when they went there, they arrived, they decided that they would make these, and this is what it's famous for, they're called moai. And these are giant statues. And when I say giant statues, there's about 900 of them exist across the island. Now, the island is not all that big, but these are between 4 and 10 metres in height and some weigh over 80 tonnes. And they were carved between round about 1200 and 1600 BC. But the amazing thing is the way they transported these, because, of course, they didn't have bulldozers or cars or trucks.
No, of course not.
They just had manpower.
How'd they do it?
And they reckon that these moai, they reckoned that the way they got them into place, because sometimes they'd move them quite a few kilometres to where they had this big quarry where they used to carve them. And as I say, these were massive. And they reckoned that the way they did this, and this is sort of generally accepted, although some people might disagree with it, they believed that they were moved by walking them to wherever they were going to be situated. Now, when I say walking them, basically the ropes were tied around the statue's head and sides, and groups of people stood on both sides and pulled the ropes back and forth, which made the statues rock side to side and slowly move forward. So you can imagine it must have taken weeks or months to move some of these
things.
Yeah.
Those pursuits are incredible. So where did you, exactly where again? Is it a fly-in, fly-out situation, Easter Island?
Ah, yes. Yes, it's a bit difficult. Now they do get there by boat, but at the most common to get there by flying. And the easiest way to get there is to fly from Santiago, which is the capital of Chile. And, of course, there's direct flights from Sydney and Melbourne to Santiago, which is easy for us. But my preferred way to go is to go via Papeete in Tahiti, because we can fly from Australia to Papeete,
Tahiti, which is
the capital of Tahiti, and you can fly direct to Easter Island from there. And I reckon that'll be a very, very exciting trip. But the interesting thing about it is, because this is so remote, the airport, or more particularly the runway, is very, very long. And the reason for that is it's about 3,300 metres, which is over 10,000 feet in the old language. And that is a very, very long runway for which is basically a smallish island. And the reason for that is because of its remoteness. If there's a plane flying across the South Pacific and encounters any trouble, it will be able to land on Easter Island. So it's very... And also... Part of the reason for it being so long is during the 1960s and 70s, during the Cold War, when the US and Soviet space race was on, the airport on Easter Island became important for NASA. And at one stage, they thought it could serve as an emergency landing for the space shuttles, because they needed very, very long runways in case they had to abort. And bear in mind that the space shuttles were coming out of orbit. And you couldn't really predict if there was a problem, you couldn't really predict where they were going to land. And so this is part of the reason why they also extended the airport. It's a really interesting story.
Just looking at the population at the moment, so we're 8,000, maybe 9,000 residents on Easter Island.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. And most of them would be these the people that I was talking about, the relatives or of the original people that went there, Polynesians that went there.
Amazing. Grumpy, you stay there. We'll come back with more in just a moment. But I just wonder whether anybody has actually been to Easter Island. I'd love to find out. Anywhere around Australia, are you familiar with Easter Island? And how did you get there, and what was the experience like for you? Just in case there is somebody who'd like to pick up the phone, 133-693.
Please apply.
How'd you like to spend Christmas on Christmas Island? How'd you like to spend a holiday away across the sea? How'd you like to spend Christmas on Christmas Island? How'd you like to hang your stocking on a great big coconut tree?
We'll go to the Christmas Islands in just a moment. Grumster, you've done the Indian Pacific, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
We just had a question and double checked it for clarification. So is that price of about $4,000, about $3,900? Is it one way or return, Perth, Sydney, Sydney, Perth?
No. It's one way. And the reason for that is, A, it's a luxury train. And you're on the train for about 3 days. Everything's included, including your drinks, and that's top shelf stuff as well, wines. They serve good wine. The food on the train is magnificent. They use a lot of local products. And the other thing is you make frequent stops for sightseeing, which is all inclusive. It's not just a train journey, it's an adventure. It's very, very comfortable. There's great lounges and great... They also have a little bit of entertainment on board and things. You really know or you really understand how big Australia is when you cross it by train. Now, you can drive across, of course, but when you drive across, you've got to stop all the time. On board the Indian Pacific, you keep going. And it's just marvellous, but depending on which way you go, from west to east or east to west. But, I mean, basically, if you're going from east to west, you start in Sydney, then you go up through the Blue Mountains and you cross the Great Dividing Range, and then you head out past Broken Hill, and you normally stop at Broken Hill to do some sightseeing, and then from there you head down to Adelaide, because the company, Journey Beyond, that runs it is based in Adelaide, and you do some sightseeing in Adelaide, and then you head up and you head over across the Nullarbor. Now, there are some stops on the Nullarbor, particularly Cook, which used to be the biggest town on there. Now, when I say town, I think there's only about 12 houses there, and it had a small hospital and stuff and a small school. But that's where all the railway workers were, all those that maintained the railway, that's where they live. And so it's an interesting just to walk around Cook. But you do some sightseeing, and you stop at one of the big cattle stations on the way as you enter Western Australia, and you have a traditional dinner there. They used to stop in Kalgoorlie. I don't know that they still do. But there are plenty of stops on the way, lots of sightseeing.
Amazing.
But it's really... When you get out on the Nullarbor Plain, because if you drive across, the Nullarbor Plain is very close to the coast. In fact, if you're driving across the Nullarbor Plain, you've got to go and stop and have a look at the Great Australian Bight. And particularly at this time of year, if you go to the head of the bight, you get all the southern right whales that come up. There's females come up from Antarctica to give birth to their calves. And last time I was there, I saw... 30 cows and their calves just in the the head of the bite. It's just amazing. But when you do the train, you are very, very, you're deep inside the Nullarbor Plain, nowhere near the coast, and it is as flat as a tack. And there's hardly, they call it Nullarbor Plain because that means, literally means no trees, and that is a very, very good description of what it's like.
I was just looking at some fares over the last couple of days. I'm not too sure why. I must have come up and clicked on the phone and clicked on something. So at the moment, there's fares around that price point, business out of Australia to a place like Milan, because the airlines are obviously struggling in the current climate, for around that same price point, you know, about $4,000 return business. It's a good time if you want to do that,
Okay. That must be a good price.
It's a very good price.
Because I've known people that have flown from Perth. They flew via Doha to, I think they went to London, but it cost, they flew business class, but it was $8,000. So if you can get it for four, that's pretty good price.
Well, they're not going through that area. So a lot of those now are trying to avoid it. Some are. But most of them are going through and picking up other destinations and making it attractive.
The direct flights that we come out of Perth, they normally go to London, Paris and Rome. They are now stopping at Singapore to refuel because they've got to go a longer way around to avoid the Middle East. So that's what's been happening,
It's one to watch. Say hello to Ian Reid, who's a great friend of this program, as you may or may not know. Ian, I don't know whether you know Steve Grumpy Collins. Good morning.
G'day, Steve. It's Ian here. Yeah, look, I listened in to you, so no, I certainly know of you, but we've never met. But I was interested in the Indian Pacific. First wife, Lynn, and our two children, we went on that train, it would be now 40 years ago, and I had a copywriter that worked for me, June Salter, and she was a travel agent. And she organised us to have the commissioner's carriage on the train. And the commissioner's carriage is about half of the carriage, and it had its own master bedroom, and it had its own living room with nice big club chairs in it, and we had our own personal butler. The two children, my son would have been probably, Ben Reed would have probably been about three, I suppose, at the time, and Jackie would have been around 10.
Yeah.
And we went from Sydney all the way across, and we got off at Kalgoorlie and then hired a car, went down to Espenshaw, bring them back to Perth that way.
Espenshaw's amazing,
very luxurious trip it was. It was incredible.
Well, yeah, because what they've done is over the ensuing years, it used to be that most of the cabins were the same, but I have seen that the commissioner's carriage, and it's pretty good. When I did my trip, there was a TV personality that was on the, I won't mention names, and had that particular carriage.
Tell us who it was. Who was it?
No, I'm not going to. Oh. I'm not going to drop names. Tony, why would I do that?
What we've done for a living for the last 40 years.
But nowadays they have upgraded a lot of the carriage so that you can have with a double bed, because most of them have got bunks, which are very comfortable, but they're still bunks. But they've got suites and stuff like that now. Of course, you pay more for those. But
of course you do.
But all of
if I can just go back to Ian for a moment. Ian, indecent, but approximately, given it's 3,900 at the moment, what would you, back in those days, Ian, do you recall approximately?
No, look, I don't. Look, June just organised it. She used to do all our trips for us. We just said, June, look, it's really great having a great travel agent and someone that you know. And you say, look, we want to go away. What do you recommend? And she said, oh, look, you know, have you done this before? So we hadn't done it. So she just organised it, and I wasn't even aware of what we were sort of getting, which was a really nice surprise, actually.
So back in the old days
when you're working 7 days a week and you're not getting home before 10 or 11 o'clock at night, you know, so it was nice to have that break.
Oh, good to have you on the program.
Well, the June Salter I knew was a prominent actress who was married to John Mellion.
Yeah, of course, all those years ago. There's a fabulous name.
Yeah.
I don't know how we got to that, talking about the Indian Pacific, except there's an inquiry, $3,900. So you reckon it's about
right. Well, it doesn't go to Easter Island, I can assure you of that.
When we come back, we might go to another one. We'll have a quick look at Christmas Island. That's next. Steve Grumpy Collins, we catch up with Steve.
Yep.
We catch up with the clever. Now, we've done Easter Island. A quick look at Christmas Island for those that may be interested, given the theme of islands on this Friday.
Yes.
Good Friday morning, Grumpy.
Well, Christmas Island was the first known spotting of it was in 1615 by a British navigator called Captain Miners. He sailed past the island, but he actually sailed past it on Christmas Day in 1643. So, that's why it was called Christmas Island. The first landing occurred in 1688, which was 45 years afterwards. And one of those on board was the English navigator William Dampier. Mm. Now, he wasn't captain of the ship yet, but, of course, at a later time, shortly after, he was the first English sailor captain to reach Australia. And he sailed down the west coast of Western Australia. Mm. Now governed by the Western Australia. It was given over to Australia in 1958 by the British, who went there and they started. It was bauxite and that there. I mean, I think the bauxite ran out, so they gifted it to Australia in 1958. But it's 2,600 kilometres northwest of Perth and only 490 kilometres southwest of Jakarta. So it is much, much closer to Indonesia than Australia. But it's a wonderful place. It is actually the tip of a volcano which goes right down to the sea floor. And so it's quite hilly, but it's got very, very lush vegetation there. A lot of it is rainforest, and most of the island, about 63%, is actually national park, which means it's protected. There's a couple of small communities there on the island, but the island is most famous for its crabs. Now, these are not crabs that live in the ocean. These are land crabs, and they're red crabs. And they're most famous because they have a spectacular annual migration where an estimated 40 to 100 million crabs march from the forests where they live to the ocean to spawn. And it's a synchronized event which transformed the island into a river of red, making it one of the world's most impressive natural spectacles. Now, at the time of this migration, driving is banned in that part of Christmas Island because they don't want you to drive over the crabs. You can't miss them. It's just amazing. The females lay their eggs in the ocean at specific times that are coordinated with the lunar cycle, which is the last quarter of the moon, and also high tide. And each of these female crabs produces up to 100,000 eggs each. It's extraordinary. Now, of course, most of those get eaten by other sea animals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't get a lot of tourists, but a lot because it's pretty hard to get to. In order to get there, you've got to fly from Perth. And to get to or from Perth, it depends which way you go via the Cocos and Keeling Islands, which are also lovely islands. They're tropical islands, but a lot further south and a lot closer to Western Australia. So it takes a while to get there, but it is phenomenal. There's great fishing there as well. You do get the whale sharks that visit. Now, really, the only other place in Australia where whale sharks visit is Exmouth, which is quite well known. There's so many great species there that are great if you're a fisherman, and they're great eating and stuff like that. The island actually lacks a wide, shallow shelf because it is literally the top of a volcano, a dormant volcano, I should say. The ocean there is very, very deep, and so the fishing is spectacular. But it's warm water there. Now, there's over 64 dive sites as well there. So if you're going up there, if you like diving, if you like fishing, etc., it's a perfect place for that. The other interesting thing, of course, is it has been in the news in recent years because when we were getting all the boat people coming to Australia, they set up a detention centre there.
Yeah, they did, which is still there. Grumpy, just going quickly, we're going to run out of time. We've got about 45 seconds. Yep. What's the best way to eat that beautiful crab?
Well, the land crabs, I don't know that they're good eating, to be honest.
Oh, really? That's ruined my story.
Because they don't live in the water. They actually live in the jungle, so I don't think they're good eating. No, I've not read of any recipes about the land crabs. No, if they're in the water, that might be different.
Well, I know up in the Kimberley, one of the indigenous leaders took us out, and we went crabbing, and then you just peel them off and just
the crab claws. The muddies,
fresh bread and butter and crab with pepper and salt was beautiful.
Oh yeah, gorgeous. A little bit of vinegar. Oh, absolutely.
Mate, I've got to let you go.
I don't know you can do that too. Yep.
Happy Easter.
All right, mate. Happy Easter. Have a Merry Christmas.
You too. Well done.
Thank you. And also Happy Easter.
Thank you. Happy
Easter. Yes. That's what time of year
happy
it is
Easter.
Already.
Thank you. I know. Happy Easter. Steve Grumpy Collins. Have a look at the YouTube and the Facebook channel for Steve Collins Traveller, regular contributor, Australia Overnight.